Picture three men. They are beyond sight or healthy diet. Isolated by a virus, they decide to turn to old TV for solace. Will they find comfort? Or will they find the Twilight Zone? Welcome to the Twilight Zone.
An increasingly perennial because of the coronavirus additional show that we're doing to talk about the Twilight Zone. And this week we watched two episodes, A Game of Pool and The Obsolete Man. We'll do The Obsolete Man first because I said these in the wrong order. That's
fine. Well, The Obsolete Man's a better episode.
It is.
Hey, spoilers.
Jason Alexander is Wordsworth. That's not the Jason Alexander we know. So, as is usual, I will read the opening narration from the first one we'll do.
Before we do that, should we go around the table and introduce everyone?
Fuck you. No, okay. So, on panel tonight we have...
Matthew W. Quinn, here in person at last, in a mask.
There you go.
Hello, this is Daniel, contributor for Popdose, and if a librarian's worthless in the future, then I've got no fucking chance.
Yeah, that's right. And?
Jeremy.
Yeah, and I'm Nick, host of Myopia and other stuff, Cineprop. Oh, and by the way, if you're hearing this now, we will not be at Atlanta Comic Con for all sorts of organizational reasons, but I know in previous episodes in the last few weeks I've mentioned that we might be at Atlanta Comic Con. It's not going to happen. We'll see you guys next time. Cineprob will return in July, it looks like. So
I'll be at Atlanta Comic Con, though, once more into the breach.
Oh, good.
Oh, there you have it.
Or you know, Mr. Quinn is desperate for money.
You know what? Cool. I'll come check you out at Comic Con, Matt.
You. And you can get a signature from the Pink Power Ranger, who will also be there. And
Amy Jo Johnson.
Amy Jo Johnson.
And Draco. Isn't Draco Malfoy still on?
Oh, I'm sure, because he needs bus fare.
Oh.
And everyone's favorite out and loud liberal right now, Ron Perlman. Is going to be there too.
Is he
going to
wrestle Ted Cruz then?
I would pay so much money.
Or whoever he was. Was it Matt Gaetz? There was someone else he threw in instead. Jim Johnson. Or Jim Jordan.
Yes.
Jim Jordan. It was the one who was like, oh, what a colossally stupid conversation that was on Twitter. Whatever.
Does that describe every conversation on Twitter?
It sure does.
It does.
But moving on to what hopefully will not become obsolete, libraries.
Yeah, well. All right, so. I'll do my opening narration. You walk into this room at your own risk, because it leads to the future. We're off and running. Not a future that will be, but one that might be. This is not a new world. It is simply an extension of what began in the old one. It has patterned itself after every dictator who planted the ripping imprint of a boot on the pages of history since the beginning. It has refinements, technological advances, and a more sophisticated approach to the destruction of human freedom. But like every one of the super states that preceded it, it has one iron rule. Logic is an enemy, and truth is menace. This is Mr. Romney Wordsworth. In his last 48 hours on Earth, he's a citizen of the state, but will soon have to be eliminated, because he's built out of flesh and because he has a mind. Mr. Romney Wordsworth, who will draw his last breath in the Twilight Zone. That's a lot of words.
It is.
Wordsworth.
Yeah, that was the most... This one is written by Sir Rod himself, Rod Serling.
Serling.
That's what he said.
I said it right this time.
He did.
Sure.
We have... We welcome back Burgess Meredith and his books again.
Much less pathetic this time.
Burgess Meredith was in a ton of these back in the day. That's why he was the narrator of the movie.
Yeah, no, that's true, and... You know, and again, he's phenomenal in this. So there's that, which is great. Matt, you want to give us a plot synopsis?
Okay, we start out basically having a show trial, yeah. Which I am convinced this is the anti-Stalinist episode because, like, they're having a show trial for a librarian because he's obsolete, and he gets to pick his own execution, and he's very clever about how he does that.
Sure.
Basically, we have the Chancellor, who thinks he's all big and bad until Wordsworth lures into his house and locks the door and says the chosen method of execution is a bomb.
Yeah. Exactly. I mean, and I also get heavy vibes here of fascism, you know, with mm-hmm. the Nazi book burnings and stuff. And, you know, they had their own show trials.
I've got actually two things I'd like to point out here. First and foremost, Matt, the anti-Stalinist episode. These were all anti-Stalinist episodes.
Oh, totally.
Second, has anybody else seen Orson Welles' The Trial? Not even Jeremy. He's shaking his head right now. That's surprising.
There's not a good version out.
Oh, yeah. And by the way, guys, if you don't listen regularly, whenever Daniel and Jeremy are next to each other, it's a dick measuring contest as to who's seen the most movies and whether they can out-reference each other. So prepare for that.
Yeah, yeah, that's going to happen. Sheesh, how many genre noir movies have you seen? Anyway, I bring it up because this came out around the same time that The Twilight Zone was still being made. I think 1962, Anthony Perkins was in it. And it just really reminded me, from a plot standpoint, of this episode.
You can tell it was an influential show. And, like, it's interesting that noir would be the thing that comes out of it. It makes sense, of course, because noir is dark and kind of brooding. It's the same way that in the 90s when you watch a wave of X-Files-esque conspiracy kind of movies came out. Because once the show becomes that significant, like, it affects the zeitgeist. And, you know, I mean, Simpsons writers ended up writing every comedy for the last 20 years. And mm-hmm. then it was The Daily Show. And then it was... Oh, God help us if it's Kimmel. But,
well, it's The Office at
now
some
the
point.
Office and, what's his name?
Greg Daniels. People. Well, yes, Michael Schur. Yeah.
So, this is actually weirdly almost a chamber drama for the first half of it. You know, it's literally, like you said, kind of a court scene where you have the totalitarian type up in the hill, like on top of this giant lectern, looking down at Burgess Meredith, who kind of meekly comes in and then is told he is a, quote, obsolete man because he reads. It's very interesting because they don't call him an enemy of the state, but mostly that his ideas are obsolete.
And well, his job is obsolete. There are no more books except for the book that he has on his desk.
Yeah, pretty much. This isn't so much about crime or about being a victim, a political victim. This is just about a future society's idea of basically being a gear... in the machine.
I mean, apparently, I think when they're at his house, they reference that they let him go on for so long because he was a carpenter.
Yes, he had a skill. Yeah.
Right. Now, did anybody else notice in the trial that he apparently had the right to lie about what he did for a living?
Yeah.
Yes.
That's why I was thinking this is Stalinism, because it has more of a built-up rule of law as opposed to just lawless violence. You know, technically you have rights.
Sure, but I mean, again, it's. I think they name-check everyone. They name-check Hitler and Mao,
mm-hmm.
and Mao must have been honored to be mentioned. this is also 61, right? So Stalin was still alive, but barely?
No, he was gone by that point.
So this is Nikita Khrushchev.
Yep.
Right? Yeah, his Cuban Missile Crisis was 60-ish.
So he was watching this on an illegal boot, and it's like, that Bay of Pigs went poorly. Plans! This is right around when the wall went up, too. Oh, no. Bay of Pigs is about to happen. That would have made a turn. This is June. Anyway, the first thing he gets that makes him also obsolete is he believes in God, and the state has proven that God doesn't exist, which is something.
Now, that was confusing for two reasons. First, and we've mentioned this before, I don't think Rod Serling was a particularly religious individual. And... if this is supposed to be a Soviet Union parallel, did the Soviet Union ever actually claim that they disproved that God existed?
Well, they were state atheism. I don't know if they would say the state has disproven God in so many words.
Well, that's the thing, though. They're officially, okay, our policy is you can't believe in God versus we have proven God doesn't exist.
I think this is more Ribbit and McCarthyism.
Yeah, okay.
If you were an atheist, you could be thrown in jail for being a communist because they were synonymous. Same with gay. If you were homosexual, you'd be thrown in jail for being, you know, a communist. It was just the nature of the thing. Also, fascism, because the Nazis were not a Christian organization. They even banned Christmas. Like, it's all chaos. Though, of course, they clung to religion when it helped them, because they were opportunists. Turns mm-hmm. out the totalitarians aren't very trustworthy.
They were really glad that the Protestant movement started in Germany.
I've been listening. I just reread Confederacy of Dunces, and he compares communists and Protestants in the same sentence constantly. It's really quite funny. But yeah, so as we're talking,
I mean, there's not terribly a lot here because this one's actually probably one of the tightest episodes we've done, right? I mean, it's well assembled, it's put together, it has a specific purpose.
Well, the entire first act is the show trial where Burgess Meredith is like screaming out a bunch of anti-state rhetoric, including the fact that he thinks there is a god. And then he has two requests. First, that the Chancellor comes by to watch him die. Second, that his execution be broadcast, basically.
Yeah.
And those are both granted, and that leads us into the second act.
Yeah, this is kind of a... It's announced that the state likes to show people being executed as a way to keep people in line, right? And this chancellor, whoever he's supposed to be, a prime minister or whatever.
Doesn't China do the same thing these days? So, like, interview people on death row right before they're executed?
Well, I know, and then there's also the bodies exhibit.
There you go.
I know they charge the family for the bullet when they shoot them in the head. I didn't know they publicized it.
Oh, that's some Brazil-level shit.
That is some Brazil-level stuff. I guess technically we pay to kill people, too. So there's that.
Well, there's that, and then there's just rubbing your face in it.
That's true.
Well, the other thing about this is he doesn't say what his method of execution is going to be. He's like, that's between me and the executioner, but you'll learn, like, the day I'm executed what's going to happen. And they're like, all right, we don't care.
You got to have a twist, Daniel. How are you going to have a twist in the second act? If everything's told on the table. So yeah, I mean, the first act of this is pretty straightforward. Actually, it's really interesting. It's almost a dialogue. There's not much else there. There's a crowd of weird people, these kind of blonde and brunette, like, men and women standing to the side that come in just to say that he's guilty of being obsolete, and then they fade back into the shadows. I mean, it would have been a good day to be a PA, I guess. But that's kind of...
The Greek chorus from hell.
They're a Greek chorus. I mean, that's exactly what they are. And they go, he's guilty, he's guilty, he's guilty. And that's kind of it. Like, the first act was actually a very long act. The next one, or I guess the next two acts, or the second and third act, or second act and epilogue, are fairly short. The day of his execution is supposed to be at midnight the next day, I believe. Mm-hmm. And he has a TV camera installed so that they can watch his execution. And the chancellor comes in.
I did like this touch about the episode where they get to his home and it's just covered in books. It's like John Waters' house.
Yeah, it's floor to ceiling. They're stacked everywhere. He has almost no furniture other than this. You know, it's like a square little room with high ceilings covered in books. You could almost argue it's the same character from the last one.
Yeah.
He kept all the books. The world didn't actually end. They found him in this hold up in this little apartment. And the dictatorial state rose out of the ashes. And you're right. He's told he was allowed to live so long, yada, 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 because he has a discernible skill, which is making furniture.
And this is also where, like you mentioned before, the chancellor is going on about, oh, well, these are our predecessors, Stalin, Hitler, and Mao.
At this point, he is perfectly fine with dying because he is a godly man, we're told. And he cracks out a Bible, which has been hidden in a, like, the arm of a piece of furniture or something. And he starts reading the Book of Psalms. Specifically, we hear him read 23 and 59. When the Chancellor arrives, the door is locked behind him, and he's told there's a bomb in the building. And if this episode slows below 50 miles an hour, he will be
And the state will not come rescue him because it makes them look weak. So they'd rather he die bravely.
Which of course means that, which of course means that the twist is that all those books were cans. They were cans.
At this point, the chancellor starts to panic, and as the bomb's ticking down, and chancellor's panicking louder and louder,
while smoking louder and louder.
The chancellor begs in the name of God to be released. And, you know, Wordsworth says, as long as it's in the name of God, he opens the door. The chancellor flings himself down a flight of stairs before the whole building explodes, which is funny.
That was a good bit, I mean, with the twist and the unlocking of the door, as long as it's in the name of God.
That's right. And then he appears at his own show trial. Because he is a godly man, he must be executed for being obsolete.
Now, there's one game that I always like to play with this, plus Jeremy's here, so I have to, of course, measure my dick in terms of references.
Yeah, sure.
Besides Burgess Meredith, the Chancellor, the biggest thing that I remember him from was Creepshow. He was one of the two professors in the crate segment, if anybody remembers that.
The one with the little fangy monster thing?
Right, exactly. He was the one that saw the monster eat a janitor and got traumatized. Not the one who deliberately fed his wife to the monster, but the other one.
Well, the guy, whatever his name is, he did a good job. Like, when he's in charge, he's all swaggering and bullying. And then when the clock is ticking, he's trying not to wimp out. And then finally he's reduced to a blubbering, cowardly POS.
Well, yep. I will also mention you. I have three things I recognized him from. And it's partially because I'm doing a rewatch of this. No one should remember this otherwise. But he's the senator that Mulder goes to in the X-Files. So he's in like four episodes of the X-Files. He's fine in that. He's also in the new Thomas Crown Affair, the one from the 90s.
Oh, okay.
Not the original, but he's in that very briefly.
The one with Pierce, not Steve.
The one with Pierce Brosnan, that's right. And I think he's in Marathon Man, but it's also not a huge role. He's fine in this. I think he's very good. He also apparently did a million things on TV, as you can imagine. Pretty much, if you were on TV once in the 50s or 60s, you did 200 things. I'm sure he's a cowboy on Rawhide, right? He came to town in one episode. He was in Night Gallery and Mission Impossible.
Hey, no shame in doing that.
I wish I could put together one script, because you know if you could get in any system, you'd be there forever. Like, FX hires the same three people to write everything for them, right? Whatever.
Well, I mean, we also got to the twist already. Well, it wasn't even a twist at this point. The Chancellor's put on the same show trial for being obsolete because he was a coward and begged for his life in the face of Burgess Meredith trying to kill him.
On TV, no less.
There you go.
Yeah, so everyone saw him be a coward.
Yeah, so that's why I thought this was a Stalin thing, because Stalin's secret police, Yezhov, he begged like a piece of shit when he was about to get it. So did Beria, witness death of Stalin. He didn't really have very strong people.
Who was that Hungarian communist that Stalin kept trying to assassinate, but then...
That was Tito, who was Yugoslav.
That's right, he was Yugoslavian. But yeah, he sent that badass telegram about... Stop trying to kill me. If you try again, I'm going to send an assassin to Moscow and I won't have to send another.
Yeah, funny.
Great big ones Tito had.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, he held off. He was an American ally for a while there. There are two versions of the narration at the end that I can give here. One was shortened. Yeah, the first one was shortened for the broadcast for whatever reason. I'll give the short one. I thought the short one was impactful. The Chancellor, the late Chancellor... Little sassy. Rod was being sassy. Was only partially correct. He was obsolete. But so is the state. The entity he worshipped. Any state, any entity, any ideology which fails to recognize the worth, the dignity, the rights of man. That state is obsolete. A case to be filed under M for mankind.
That is real good.
I don't know. It's so funny. I can tell when Rod writes for himself because it's a little punchier. This one, he clearly had something he wanted to say. And I don't know... what happened in, like, mid-1960 that he wanted to write about. But this feels pointed. For whatever reason, something made him want to write this episode. And who knows, maybe it was something he saw in the States that reminded him a little bit too much of something that happened in Russia. Because this feels like I'm going to tell them a fable.
Well, right? they never specify exactly what the state is or what its belief system is. It could be the Soviet Union. It could very well be like President McCarthy rewrote the Constitution or something.
That's right. I mean, and again, it's 1960, so it's entirely possible that... Or this is 61, so it's entirely possible that Nixon ran on something about how he was a communist fighter and then threatened people. Like, who knows? Because, no... I'm sorry, I've got to out that Alger Hiss. You're like...
I'm going to feed Alger Hiss to checkers.
He did. I mean, he...
Those goddamn communists in the State Department are just driving me bananas.
Checkers will sniff him out.
My favorite little clip of him is there was a pumpkin patch outside of D.C. where the insiders were passing information out of a hollow pumpkin. There's a film clip of him just reaching out, pulling the top off the pumpkin, and pulling a little letter out of it. You're just like, oh, I was... That is so clearly stupidly staged. Anyway, let's jump to the next one.
Are you kidding me? That pumpkin was almost my Secretary of State.
That's about right. I interview better than a pumpkin.
Is that like how Kissinger actually sounded?
Yeah.
Yeah.
He sounded like Arnold Schwarzenegger?
No, he sounded more monotone, more like this, because he was just not really a human being.
You unlock this door with the key of imagination. Beyond it is another dimension. A dimension of sound. a dimension of sight, a dimension of mind. You're moving into a land of both shadow and substance, of things and ideas. You've just crossed over into the Twilight Zone.
So we're back, guys. We're doing a second episode on the Twilight Zone. This one is called A Game of Pool. And as normal, I will read the introduction. This one's short. Jesse Cardiff, a pool shark, the best on Randolph Street, who will soon learn that trying to be the best at anything carries its own special risks. In or out of the Twilight Zone. Short, sweet, which means it wasn't written by Rod Serling.
Now, the twist is that this is actually a game of croquet.
That there's a swimsuit competition at the end of this game of pool.
Oh, well, I mean, seeing Jonathan Winters in that swimsuit. Girl.
So anyway.
And that fat guy, for those who like him thick.
Oh, gosh. So, Jeremy, you want to get the plot synopsis of this one?
Yeah, this one's fairly simple, and I kind of like it for that. It's Jesse Cardiff is a pool shark who is sad that he never got a chance to play this legendary pool shark who was claimed to have been the best in the world, and somehow his pleas get up to heaven, where the pool shark is said, "You are needed down at this pool hall on Baxter Street."
That's right.
And magically he appears, challenges Jesse to a match, and says, "Hey, you wanted me here, so let's see who's the best."
Now, Jeremy, is it heaven?
Yeah, I'm thinking it's not heaven.
No, I mean, it's like the world's greatest sports bar. Like, you get the feeling that there's also, like, a bowler the next, like, just down the way, like...
If you rack him, he will come.
Nicely done.
But yeah, like, I dig this. Because, like, the whole idea is that, of course, there's someone who wants to challenge you for the throne constantly. The guy's, the late, great Jonathan, or is he dead?
Yeah, Jonathan Winters passed away.
Yeah.
I did want to curse him accidentally. But the guy's named Fats Brown.
Fats Brown.
Mm-hmm. And he's played by Jonathan Winters, who, phenomenal as always.
Oh, yeah.
Now, I'm going to ask Jeremy this question because he's probably the only one who can answer it. Is this also the plot of The Color of Money?
Is that the Paul Newman movie?
Yeah,
with Tom Cruise in it.
Yeah.
Oh, God, that's right. Early. Wait, remember, because let's not forget, Tom Cruise is about to file for Social Security. The man.
Oh, boy, he is.
Like he's 40.
Yeah, him and Paul Rudd are in a race to stay young forever.
And want to do his own stunts in the space station.
Oh, God, help us. Do you think he's actually, like, NASA's going to help him, like base jump from the International Space Station?
I hope they do. I mean, that would, speeding the exploitation of space.
I mean, sure. Also, I hope he fucking dies doing it. Can that? I mean, like, I love Tom Cruise. I do. But the man is an idiot. You can't keep doing these things. He, in fact, had to make his own insurance company so he could make the last two Mission Impossibles because of how risky he was doing.
Well, you know what? I respect that about him. He's getting a little long in the tooth, but he'll actually still do his own stunts. And well,
he might be physically fitter at 60-ish than I am at 36 almost.
How old are you? Do you remember?
36.
Well, he's got a million...
Time doesn't matter these days.
He's got a million reasons to be, Matt.
At this point, he'll be older than John Glenn when he goes to space.
Oh, boy.
That's a good one.
And I like these Mission Impossible movies. I assume that's what he's going to do to go to space. But the recent string... Is the same guy coming back, Kevin McClory?
Christopher McQuarrie.
That's the one.
Yeah.
Christopher McQuarrie.
Kevin McClory.
The best video he started last year was the one on how to turn off motion smoothing on your TV. Yeah. Did you see that?
Yeah, I saw that. Yeah.
Man is doing God's work. Or Xenu's work, I guess.
Speaking of God's work, let's get back into Fats Brown being dead and coming down to challenge this underling who...
That reminds me, what was the name of the guy from The Hustler? Wasn't it like Minnesota Fats or something?
No, Minnesota Fats was a real dude. He was something Fats.
The whole thing about this is the intro is weird because it's like this 2 or 3 minute monologue with the challenger who's like alone in a pool hall wondering why he never got to play against Fats Brown. And it's like, dude, you're really sad.
I think that's the whole point of it.
Yeah.
Oh, it is Minnesota Fats.
Yeah.
Oh, how do you know? Never mind. We're all fine. Oh, so at this point, like, it's literally just a game of pool, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, they're playing 300, which is quite simply, each ball's worth 1 point. And the
loser gets kicked down a never-ending pit.
That's right. I mean, part of it was...
This is the pool hall!
Oh, there you go. Jesse Cardiff is played by another famous actor who you probably recognize from
Klugman.
Thousand Things.
Klugman.
Yeah, Jack Klugman, who is in from The Odd Couple, of other things. Yeah. 12 Angry Men, Days of Wines and Roses. He's in a whole bunch of stuff. And actually, of all things, this actually has a very interesting writer. We don't usually talk about the writers here. He wrote the first episode of Star Trek.
Oh, shit.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah, I mean, he and in fact, his script became the Ocean's 12. Like, he wrote the story that became Ocean's 12 in 1960, and then, of course, remade in 2012 for Ocean's 11. He also wrote Logan's Run. He also wrote, like, he did a lot. He wrote 4 episodes of The Twilight Zone. This is the only one we're doing. But, you know, he essentially started Star Trek as well, writing The Man Trap. And an episode of Kung Fu. Kind of a, just a creepy guy with a huge beard and, I guess, a taste for the macabre. Sci-fi, yeah. Fantasy, whatever.
Okay, grasshopper.
Yeah, there you go. Like Jeremy said, there's not a lot to talk about, but that's what makes this good.
Well, the whole thing's kind of weird because Fats doesn't act like a man. He acts more like Pip did in a previous episode, A Nice Place to Visit. It's all about him challenging his challenger's beliefs and their dedication to pool.
I think he's trying to keep him from living like he did. It's like, you know, the in the Bible, the rich man who goes to hell and he's like, you know, send Lazarus till my 5 brothers will end up here.
Well, we're jumping ahead a little bit, but considering what happens at the end of the episode, is Fats deliberately losing to the guy?
I think he intentionally misses his last shot. I think that's what we're supposed to believe. Because he wants to give up the mantle.
Right.
But man, is this a tight episode. Like, I'm with you. I like these kind of... It's essentially one scene. Mm-hmm. Other than him, like, being called up from the big leagues, right?
Yeah.
It's just... And this guy's story is fantastic. Like, he made friends with the bartender so he could play extra rounds at night. He essentially practices all the time.
He's never, hasn't read a book or gone on a date in years. It's, like, really unhealthy.
Well, yeah. I also have not been on a date in what seems like years.
Well, that's what happens with all the top athletes. I mean, I know Tiger Woods was being out there trained to golf when he was, like, a toddler, and... same with, I think, Maria Sharapova before she up and quit this year.
Well, and the Williams sisters talk about, like, essentially every waking moment their dad was playing tennis with them. Like,
plus, Peyton Manning, I think, the same thing, too, right?
Also, Peyton Manning is just, you know, a huge, terrifying person.
So. Oh, yeah. The fact that you're calling him a huge, terrifying person says something.
That's true. I mean, and I know, not name-checking anything, but I know... the head coach of the Rams, and even in high school, he was that guy. You know, he played football at Miami of Ohio, where I went as well, and I've met him several times, and he's a nice guy, but that's all he does. He thinks football, he talks football, that's how you become the best at anything.
Right.
You know, that's why we podcast every third week, because we're not the best at literally...
and Fats is telling him, like, I've been on vacation, I've made love, this being the 60s, that's a little... ooh. And, like, all this...
sex stuff. Was invented in the 60s.
Well, wait a minute. That being the 60s, apparently making love was controversial.
I love the... also, I just picture this because Jonathan Winters talks out of the bottom of his mouth the whole time, like, with his lower jaw. There's him going...
yeah.
And just... I've made love, and I'm just like, oh, that was very unpleasant love for everyone involved.
Well, I'm sure Jonathan Winters was telling the truth.
I was going to say...
let's be honest.
He looks really sharp in that outfit, too.
Oh, yeah.
With the vest and the white pressed shirt and his visor on. Like,
yeah, part of me was like, wait, is that really Jonathan Winters? Because, damn.
Yeah, because he was a snack in that. Yeah. I mean, like, he really was great.
Yeah.
But, yeah, so essentially, like you were saying, like, the score is like 297 to 297. Jesse Cardiff gets the last couple breaks after Fats intentionally misses a shot.
One of the things that this episode does properly is it's really suspenseful, which for a game of pool is rare. I mean, it's like making bowling suspenseful.
Right.
Oh, come on. You haven't seen Kingpin, right?
Oh, Kingpin.
I have seen Kingpin. Oh. Kingpin is a comedy.
And it's still suspenseful.
It's great. I almost said Wooderson. My God.
Well,
it's Bill Murray steals that last act.
I'll put it this way, Jeremy. The Chariots of Fire theme. Can you imagine that to a game of pool?
Super slow-mo, kind of like the balls are running across the beach. Okay. Well. Oh, rest in peace to Ian Holm.
Oh, speaking of which. Yeah, and we're about to record back to back because for those of you who aren't subscribed, we're going to record our episode on Alien Covenant, and I'm sure we'll get into it because one of the first places I saw him was in that first Alien movie. That was a surprisingly hard one because I don't think about him constantly as not that he's not a great actor, but he doesn't come to mind immediately. And then I saw his film credits. I'm like, so everything I've liked in the last 20 years, he's dipped his toe in. Last 20 years, last 40 years.
Bilbo has gone into the West.
He's with the elves.
Can you imagine that as the afterlife? Just a lot of tall, boring people? So me. Just me and Jeremy in the afterlife. Hey, how you doing?
I'm glad I wasn't included in that.
But you're not that tall.
Oh, there you go.
Anyway... By the way, I kept expecting this a different twist, which is like something like a deal with the devil. Like, you know, I didn't know what the end game was. And the fact is, it's a be careful what you wish for because you might get it kind of a thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like that how that initially you're thinking, oh, my God, if he loses, he's going to die. But as it gets closer to the end, you're going to think, oh, my God, he's going to win.
Yeah.
Well, that's the big...
Yeah, that's great.
That's the big twist. First and foremost, the stakes are if he loses to Fats, he's going to die. And he wins against Fats at the last shot. But because he wins, he apparently lives a full life. But then he takes Fats' place in purgatory or hell or heaven or wherever that is.
I think it's purgatory because you can get out.
Yeah, that makes sense.
He's got, but I guess he's got to go do this until he finally...
Which, that's one thing that I don't get about this episode. You can deliberately lose and exit purgatory that way.
Well, because it's all about your reputation. I don't think it actually matters, right? This is a memory. This is a game of whatever. In fact, it also kind of reminds me of, like, again, we were talking about Westerns earlier, like a Western. Like, there's that one gunslinger that everyone's to challenge to a duel.
Do you remember that Farsight comic about the cowboys meeting up in the center of town at high noon to play a game of ping pong? And it's like...
Oh, you beat me, son.
Yeah. Well, you beat me. Now every paddle thrower is going to be looking for you. Welcome to hell, kid.
Yeah, that's what it is.
Yeah. Yeah, part of me wondered, like, at the end where he's trying to dissuade him from winning, saying, you know, this really isn't going to be as good as you think. It was kind of like an angel trying to get his wings, like trying to guide him on the right path.
Well, he says something interesting there. He's like, well, I had to say that.
Well, but at the same time, he misses the last shot. He gives him the opportunity to say, look, this is what my life became hell because of this, right? I'm warning you. This is him giving him an honest shot. And so by missing the shot, he gives him the opportunity to either win or to lose, right? Because it wouldn't be the same if Jonathan Winters wins the game on his own, right?
Right.
He has to give Cardiff the option. Again, the simplicity here makes it so we can talk more. It reminds me, what we did that one with the Eye of the Beholder. There's more to talk about because there's nothing to that episode. Other than the fact that apparently Rod Serling is a Chud person too. I also, again, this is a great one for just watching where Rod Serling comes from, because he's just drinking at a bar, kind of. Like, he's in a pool hall, and you're just like, yeah, of course he's in a pool hall. Like, I imagine he did that a lot. But yeah, this is a great episode.
Yeah, it was.
Anything else you want to touch on? I mean, like, the this one is so straightforward. Both of these are fairly straightforward, but this one in particular, there's not a lot to, which I think gives it a great deal of strength.
Well, do you mind if I jump to my final judgment between the two episodes? I honestly preferred A Game of Pool over the previous one because Obsolete Man was fairly straightforward, but this one, even though it's seemingly much more simple, has a lot more to say about obsession and drives and how those can just destroy your life, literally in this case. I don't know. This is one that I hadn't seen before this recording. I had seen The Obsolete Man before, but man, this one was really good.
Yeah, I gotta agree with that. When you figure out what's going on, it seems kind of simple at its base, but yeah, it has a lot to do about life. It has two great actors just nailing it. It's suspenseful. It's basically Whiplash 50 years before Whiplash.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it, actually. Yeah. Matt?
I like The Obsolete Man better. I think it was more entertaining and better performance overall. But I do like how they elaborated on the younger pool player's character. Like, he keeps ranting at one point about how he wasn't good at anything until he started playing pool. Like, he's not just an obsessive bad sport. There's like a lot of psychological reason for that, and that was interesting.
So which one do you prefer?
I still think Obsolete Man is better, but this is a surprisingly thoughtful episode for a pool duel to the death.
Yeah. I am
more torn, I think, than anyone here. I think the first one is excellent. Rod Serling on his high horse is really something to see. I mean, because he had something he wanted to say that time. That doesn't make it bad. I think it's a very powerful episode. It's interesting in these incredibly political times that we're living in. And I think it's got value. I think as far as the Twilight Zone, the second one felt more like a Twilight Zone episode, because what makes good sci-fi horror fantasy than having a message, like a moral? Like, the thing was with the first one, I know what the moral was. It's a very obvious moral. It's very on the nose. That doesn't make it bad. It's just not a lot to it. It's fascism is bad, totalitarianism is bad. Whatever you want to pick is bad. And I tricked you. I exploded you. This one, I think, is more fun. This one, I'd say, I'd rewatch more often. Obsolete Man just feels very much like we're getting there. I'll read the closing narration. I think then we're done. Mr. Jesse Cardiff, who became a legend by beating one, but who has found out that after his funeral, that being the best of anything carries with it a special obligation to keep on proving it. Mr. Fats Brown, on the other hand, having relinquished the champion's mantle, has gone fishing. These are the ground rules in the Twilight Zone. How wonderfully simple.
Yeah, that's just so great.
I mean, again, it makes sense. This guy is someone you'd hire to write, like, the pilot of your TV show. Like, I don't know why, like, because you get the show immediately. If this was the first episode of The Twilight Zone, I'd get what The Twilight Zone was. I have no complaints. I like this very much.
Yeah.
Anyway, so next week is week 10 of 13 of The Twilight Zone Zone. We're nearly done. Obviously, you can follow along with us. We've been posting these. Of course, we've had guests on here. We've decided that we're going to finish this out, quarantine or not. And then in the fall, when we inevitably get locked down again, we're trying to decide if we'll do something else. Matt, Daniel, and I have been kicking around ideas, but we will see. In the meantime, stay tuned next week for the Twilight Zone. Zone. Thanks, guys. The Twilight Zone Zone is a production of Dude Letter Podcasting and Myopia Defend Your Childhood. It is hosted by Nick Hoffman, paneled by Daniel S. and Matt Quinn. It is edited by Nick and Daniel. The theme song is Six Impromptus, Opus 5, Impromptu 5 by Jean Sibelius. The list is from Vanity Fair, the 26 episodes we talk about when we talk about The Twilight Zone by Donald Liebenson. The Twilight Zone is created, hosted, and mostly written by Rod Serling. The Twilight Zone and all clips are owned by CBS Television and Cayuga Productions.